Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Denver, where the site of the Democratic Convention, and speak with Ari Berman, who's a contributing writer for The Nation, where he covers national politics and focuses on the 2008 presidential election. He's also an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute, and we'll be talking to him in a little while about the extent to which the divisions in the Democratic Party will be healed in the course of this week-long convention and the reception of the vice presidential choice, Joe Biden, by the rank-and-file Democrats. We'll then go to Mexico City and speak with Dr. John Ackerman, who's a professor at the Institute for Legal Research at the National University in Mexico, in Mexico City. He's going to be joining us to talk about Mexico, of course, doesn't get a lot of coverage, although it is our neighbor to the south, and the country is being absolutely torn apart by violence, much of which is perhaps perpetrated by the police. And there have been a number of assassinations of senior police officials. There'll be a huge protest in Mexico City on Saturday, a public revulsion against or a plea for public security. And Sunday, of course, there's a massive demonstration about Pemex, that state-controlled oil company, which is the main economic lifeline of Mexico, which is losing both its reserves and its money rapidly. So that'll be it's a question of whether or not it will be privatized. It will be a part, of course, of the big demonstration. And then we'll talk with Aziz Haq, who directs the Liberty and National Security Project at New York University's Brennan Center for Justice. Aziz Haq clerked for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the Supreme Court, and he is also co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And we're talking to him about the Attorney General's push for new FBI powers to spy on American citizens. Let's begin now with Ari Berman, who is in Denver, the site of the Democratic Convention. And I don't imagine you've been able to take the pulse quite yet. It doesn't start till tomorrow, Ari, but what's the sense of how much Joe Biden is going to be an agent for healing the divisions within the party, which I think are pretty clear between the ascendant supporters of Barack Obama and the jilted supporters of Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, well, I am here in Denver, and I think it is, yes, a little early to get a pulse of the place. I've only been to a few functions, and there were mostly journalists there. Not the 15,000 journalists that were there, but maybe a few hundred already. I think Joe Biden is obviously the talk of the town here. I think in terms of his impact on the Clinton supporters, it remains to be seen. You know, he didn't endorse anyone in the primary, and he's not really a Clinton person. So unlike some of the other people that were floated, he didn't endorse Clinton in the primaries. But he has long-standing relationships with a lot of people in the party, including a lot of prominent Democrats. But I think really it's going to be Hillary and Bill Clinton who will have to do the healing. What they say in their speeches, what they say outside of the speeches, how they present the case for Barack Obama to their own supporters, I think will be very telling. I think a lot of the disaffection with the Clinton supporters has been overhyped in the media, quite frankly. I think it's a small group of holdouts, but they're good at creating a lot of rancor in the debate and getting a lot of coverage.
Well, the Clintons themselves, their churlish behavior has led a lot of people to think that they are less than enthusiastic about Obama. So isn't it incumbent upon them to, at least if that is not their true attitude, then they don't they owe the party a full embrace of Obama and Biden?
Yeah, and I think you're going to see that. I think Hillary Clinton has already begun to do that. She's been campaigning for Obama. She's been out there making the case for him. I think the real person who needs to do it is Bill Clinton. He said very, very little about Obama since Obama won the nomination. What he has said hasn't been too generous. So I think if Bill Clinton comes out on Wednesday night and gives a really rousing, heartfelt endorsement of Obama, which by all indications he's going to do, that will go, I think, a decent way towards healing some of these divisions. I think no one knows what the Clintons think in their heart. They may still absolutely hate Barack Obama, but they realize this is politics. And if a Clinton wants to move forward in 2012 or 2016 or whatever and run for president again, if Bill Clinton wants to preserve his status as the elder statesman of the party, they're going to have to embrace the fact that this is now Obama's party. And the Clintons will play a starring role in that, but they're no longer the main attraction. And I think picking Joe Biden, he's not a Clinton person, but he's very much a consummate Washington insider. He, in fact, probably is the consummate Washington insider. And I think Obama feels like he'll know how to navigate some of these tricky divisions in the party just because he's been around so long and has so many relationships with so many different people.
But roughly speaking, Ari Berman, in this country, there are the two parties. One is the Republicans are a minority party who make sure their people vote and try to do as everything they can to discourage other people from voting. And they've been pretty successful. And their success always depends upon peeling off a number of Democratic Party votes, at least 10%. Bush got, I think, 13% in 2004. And on the Democratic side, they are a natural majority, but they fail to inspire their ranks. If they do inspire their ranks and bring in all of the potential Democratic voters, then they sweep. So, yeah. I mean, is there a sense that there's been too much fratricide and not enough unity?
Not really. I mean, like I say, if you look at the number of supporters of Hillary Clinton who aren't backing up Barack Obama, it's still a pretty small number. And I think they think that getting closer to the election, that number will continue to decrease. But I think what the Obama campaign and what the Democrats are focused on now is bringing actually in new voters to the party. One reason they did the convention here in Denver is because it's such a fast-growing state, Colorado, and there's so many Hispanic voters here, for example, that the Democrats want to lock into the party. There's a lot of young voters that they're trying to get into the party. They're trying to pump African-American turnout beyond where it normally is to an even larger extent. And then pick off, I think, some moderate swing state Republicans who have been disenchanted with George W. Bush and disenchanted with John McCain. And even if McCain picks off some Clinton supporters, if Obama can pick off some disaffected Bush supporters, then I think he'll probably be okay. But certainly, if you look at the demographics, I mean, Denver and Colorado is a state where there's a lot of new voters coming into the party, and I think they're going to try to showcase that this entire week.
Let me ask you about the astounding number of corporate sponsors. I mean, I made this sort of offhand remark that it's almost as if the Republicans are the party of big business and corporate America, but the Democrats are kind of corporate light, and the extent to which Pepsi Cola, the number two brand, appears to be prominent in the Democratic convention. Give us a flavor of
Well, the corporate sponsorship is everywhere. I mean, you fly into the airport and you drive out and you see that the Denver signs are sponsored by AstraZeneca, a pharmaceutical company. The event's held at the Pepsi Center. AT&T is the official sponsor of the convention. I mean, virtually every big name corporate sponsor is here. It's almost like the Olympics in a way. And they'll also be in Minneapolis, too. And some of this is rather innocuous, and they're just doing it because this is what they're expected to do. And some of it is very insidious. And there will be lots of parties that are very hard to get into that are thrown for lawmakers by lobbyists that will take place behind closed doors. And you're seeing that Obama's message of change is always constantly pushing up against the status quo. And what the status quo is basically doing is they want to co-opt this. They want to say, okay, we can handle some of this as long as we can maintain our access. And by all indications, at this convention, they still have their access. There's no doubt about it. The lead fundraiser for the convention for the Obama campaign is, in fact, himself a lobbyist, Steve Farber. He's not working directly for the Obama campaign, but clearly he's organizing the convention that's going to be featuring Obama. So there's corporate money everywhere. There's lobbyists everywhere. These are just kind of the rules of the game. And even the new politics, quote unquote, can't really break that.
So it's almost like this is a could be a business convention, and that lobbyists are an integral part of the they're in the political business.
Exactly. It's not like they're the only group here. I mean, obviously, there are lots. There are labor unions, there are environmental groups, there are women's groups. There's all the different constituencies of the Democratic Party, and they're sponsoring it, too. So you'll see a kind of funny thing where you'll see SEIU is next to, let's say, Pfizer in terms of sponsors. So in some ways, business is just, yes, another constituency in the party, but quite a powerful one.
Well, I guess the question is whether they are parasites feeding off the host or whether they control the host.
I think it's probably a bit of both.
And what about the demonstrators out there? I believe it's a mixture of anti-globalists and anti-abortionists.
Yeah, well, we came into the main media party last night, and there was a sign that says Obama is for dead babies, so or something along those lines. So they're always there. There will be protesters. There will be some anti-war protesters. There will be some anti-globalization protesters. There will be protesters aligned with Ralph Nader and Cynthia McKinney. And then I think you'll also see some Clinton supporters protesting. I don't think any of these protests are going to be that big. I think if any of them manage to get much coverage, it'll probably be the Clinton protests, given the magnitude of that story.
And tell me about the leaked document that you came into possession of.
Oh, well, just what happened was is that this lobbying firm, Clinton Gillespie, put out a list of all these parties. It wasn't so different from, honestly, from a lot of the other lists that were circulating around. And somewhat from the Sunlight Foundation, which is a very good think tank dedicated to open government, got a hold of the list and sent it out to a lot of people. And it was kind of funny. The Democratic list was five times as long as the Republican list, which is probably a bit of a role reversal. I think it just goes to show you how many more people are going to be at this convention than the one in St. Paul. Even Republican senators can't seem to get a flight to Minneapolis these days.
So, in other words, the Democrats are attracting lobbyists and business and nonprofits and all kinds of lobbyists because the perception out there is that they're the winners?
Exactly. I mean, you know, for all the talk about the ideology of business is very malleable. And they like to go with winners. And so they see the Democrats took over Congress. They see Obama's chances as still at upward of 50%. And they think this is the guy we need to be paying attention to. Not that they're not going to pay attention to John McCain, but Denver is just so much more of a scene than St. Paul will be.
And you mentioned, I asked you earlier about Joe Biden. Obviously, he's on Tuesday night, isn't he?
He's on
Wednesday night.
Bill Clinton should be speaking before him.
Right. And will he introduce him?
I don't know if he'll quite introduce him, but he will be speaking, I think, right before him. The schedule is not set yet.
And so I guess that probably of all the candidates, the only one that could have brought Obama some votes were Hillary, and there was still some sense that maybe he'd pull that off, but then we learned that he hadn't even vetted her. So,
well, I mean, he could have pulled her some votes. He also could have cost her a lot of votes.
Right.
She could have also cost him a lot of votes. I mean, the dynamic of putting Hillary on the ticket is very complicated, not only from a governing perspective, from even from a political perspective. The Republican base is still in a fair amount of disarray, and I think putting someone like Clinton on the ticket could get Republicans motivated in a way they are not. But I just think it was never a tenable situation. I mean, she said so many nasty things about him in the primary that it would have been difficult to do that. But also, I just think Bill Clinton was just way too much of a wild card. It was hard enough to have him be the potential first man. And then to be the potential, I don't even know what you'd call it,
first man in waiting,
presidency.
I guess. Yeah.
First man in waiting is even more complicated. And I just think, you know, all the stuff that Clinton's been doing since he left the presidency, the donors to his library, the donors to his foundation, the work of his foundation, all his business partners overseas, et cetera, I just think it made it almost impossible to actually vet him. And I think it was Bill that probably may have cost Hillary the vice presidency. And I think Joe Biden, who knows what he'll add to the ticket, but I don't think he takes much away. He is a safe pick with some upside, some downside, but I think in the end, the upside probably outweighs the downside in terms of putting him on the ticket.
And on the Republican side, of course, they're expected to announce their VP, or McCain is, on Friday.
Yeah.
And there have been some indications that he's sort of floated a trial balloon that he may even consider not just Colin Powell, which I think is total fantasy, and
yeah, that's not
I think
happening.
They've made that up. But he also mentioned the possibility of Tom Ridge, who would help him enormously in Pennsylvania,
yeah.
who is pro-choice, and also Lieberman, of course, who's also pro-choice. There was a howls of protest from the religious right, and it suggests to me that perhaps he was floating those names in order to immunize the most likely choice, which is Romney. So
yeah.
that the Christian right will breathe a sigh of relief that it's that it's not
yeah.
Ridge or Lieberman.
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota, was kind of a safe choice for McCain. Seemed to by all indications, have locked it up. But Pawlenty may be even a little too bland for McCain. He's someone that you pick if you want to reassure people, but he doesn't really add all that much. By all indications, he's going to win Minnesota with or without Pawlenty on McCain's ticket. Mitt Romney, again, I think is kind of a safe choice. I don't think he gives McCain a whole lot. He's younger and he's more telegenic, and he supposedly is an expert in economics, although in his job he was more of a downsizer than anything else. So I'm not sure how much he'll really add. And then I think McCain is toying with the idea of putting a few different women on the ticket. Meg Whitman, the former CEO of eBay, Carly Fiorina, the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard. In the end, I don't think either of those people will be qualified enough to get the position. I think Tom Ridge still remains a possibility. Yeah, the Republican base may get upset, but he is a Republican, a solid Republican, and he gets from a very important swing state. And I think Joe Lieberman is just not happening. I mean, no matter how much Democrats hate Lieberman on Iraq and on issues of war and peace, he is basically a Democrat on most domestic and social issues. He's pro-choice, he's pro-environment, he still caucuses with the Democrats. And I think the religious right and conservative Republicans will just go crazy if Lieberman is put on McCain's ticket. And I don't know if I doubt ever in history we've had a vice presidency from both parties.
Right, but they've certainly, he's a prominent speaker at the Republican convention, and he's a former vice presidential running mate for Gore, who by all accounts won in 2000.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He's definitely being used by the Republicans, even if he does caucus with the Democrats.
Yeah.
I think
but it's different for him to be a featured McCain surrogate and then or be one step away from the presidency. I mean, it's a lot different in Republicans' minds.
Yeah, well, I guess he's being used without being rewarded.
Yeah.
I thank you for joining us, Ari Berman. And
thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello again, Amy Masters. Just speaking then with Ari Berman, who's in Denver, the site of the Democratic Convention, which begins on Monday. He's a contributing writer to The Nation. He covers national politics and focuses on the 2000 election. And he's also an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. I'm now speaking with Dr. John Ackerman, who's a professor at the Institute of Legal Research at the National University in Mexico City. And John, obviously, we've been distracted here with the war between Russia and Georgia and with the presidential campaign, which, of course, is now in its convention phase for the next couple of weeks. So Mexico gets kind of short shrift, but through the sort of background, you keep hearing stories about the disquiet that the citizens have in that country, revulsion against flagrant kidnapping and the murdering of almost serial murdering of all the top officials. It just goes on and on. So I understand it's going to come to a head next Saturday, and also on Sunday there'll be a huge demonstration about the national patrimony, which is the Pemex Oil Company.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Ian, thanks for the call. Pleasure to talk to you, as always. I'm glad you're turning your head south a little bit. There's a lot going on, but Mexico is very important, and it continues to be so. We are in a very delicate, complicated situation at this moment, for these two two issues. On one hand, public security is a major concern. There have been hundreds of assassinations this year so far in related to drug and narco trafficking. There have also been hundreds of kidnapping. Kidnappings are up to a record high. These are not necessarily linked to drugs, but also very much linked to organized crime, of course. There is also right on the table, as you mentioned, a major reform to the National Oil Company, which has led to a major political division. Well, of course, the divisiveness in terms of political issues has been there since the 2006 elections, but this is sort of, has brought things back up to the surface in terms of a large proportion of the population being against the privatization, another important part of the population supported by the government in favor of handing over important parts of the oil company to private oil companies. On the public security issue, there really is a serious crisis in this area, and the government doesn't seem to be doing a whole lot about it. This last Thursday, there was a major meeting in the National Palace where the president organized a conference in which all the governors came, the Supreme Court justices, legislators, head of the Congress, all the cabinet members were there, and they signed a national pact in favor of public security. Unfortunately,
isn't that their primary obligation? I mean,
exactly.
Who are they fooling here?
That's kind of the reaction that's been it's been drawing throughout the media. It's very nice to have a pact, but this is sort of a pact to do what they're supposed to be doing anyway. It doesn't have any kind of real specific commitments in this pact. It's basically just a public show, basically created by a situation a few weeks ago. The son of a prominent businessman here in Mexico was discovered dead, who he had been kidnapped, and they didn't know what had happened to him, and he was discovered dead in a car in Mexico City. And that led to a major move on the part of the important sort of business groups to pressure the government to do something. So this is their effort to make it appear as if they're doing something. This has sort of been the strategy of Calderon all along. When he came in 2006, December of 2006, his major policy initiative or political initiative was to send the troops, the military, out into the street to combat the narcos. And this is looks, sounds impressive, and you know, got some good media reactions. But in general, this is not really the correct strategy to actually rooting out drug-related crime in Mexico. Of course, what you need to do is investigate and infiltrate and really find the criminals instead of just sending up military patrols all over the country. So this is sort of part of the same strategy of trying to look as if he's doing something serious and changing the direction, when we don't actually see a real change in the policy focus that's going on here. Mm-hmm.
And it seems, though, Dr. John Ackerman, that the reverse has happened. Rather than the police infiltrate the criminals and using intelligence, it seems that the police themselves have been infiltrated by the criminals, and mm-hmm. time and again. And the murder of the wealthy teenager indicates, I think, that it was the renegade police that did that.
Yes, exactly. That's the suspicion. It wouldn't be a surprise at all. Many of these kidnappings are organized by either acting police officers or recently fired or people who have served in the police or the military in recent years. This is definitely a common theme in issues of public security. Corruption, I think, is really at the heart of all of this. There's a very serious problem with corruption in the police forces in Mexico. This also is related, of course, to the oil industry issue. One of the reasons why Mexico is not productive enough in oil is because of the also high level of corruption that exists in the state oil company. And this is a very important topic which has affected Mexico for many years. Mexico is really at the sort of a very low level on the international list of most corrupt countries, at the level of Morocco or China. It's one of the worst, most corrupt countries in all of Latin America. The only country that's more corrupt than Mexico on these international ratings is Haiti, much more corrupt than even Brazil, Chile, etc. And unfortunately, the transition to democracy, the alternation of parties who are in power, has not led to a new, innovative, powerful strategy to combat corruption. It seems as if basically what's happened is that the new party, the PAN, has just sort of gotten on top of the old systems of sort of corporatist and corrupt government. So, for instance, just a symbolic thing, this last Thursday, this major pact for public security, two of the most important sort of witnesses who also signed the pact are Elbester Gordillo and Carlos Romero de Champs. These names might not mean much to people out there in L.A. or in the United States, but these are the two of the most important dinosaur, they're called, in terms of sort of old guard, pre-union leaders of the party of the Institutional Revolution. These people have been in power for 20, 30 years, and absolutely nothing has changed in their power authority through the transition of government in 2000. So we really have the same structures of authoritarian power in place, which have not changed radically through the celebration of elections in the last 10 years. And so we're really at a problematic point. Things should be moving forward, but something's stopping them, and there's a lack of political will, both at the federal and the local governments.
And Dr. John Ackerman, the structure of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which is, of course, in itself an oxymoron, they almost control power totally for as long as the Communist Party of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And recently sort of became unglued, but it seems that, as you were indicating, that the successor party, the PAN, has not been able to break that structure. They were never able to get a majority in the Congress, the perception is that the previous PAN president, Vicente Fox, was a failure, in as much as he didn't really attack the structures and didn't seem to make any headway with the Congress.
Right.
And of course, the cynical part of the PRI thing was that they enabled people like Carlos Hank Gonzalez, who's famously went from a rural school teacher to a multi-billionaire. And his famous adage was, "A poor politician is indeed a poor politician." And part of the arrangement they made was with the left, was co-opting the unions, and that's at the heart of the problem with Pemex, isn't it? That it's not that the unions and the PRI have been stealing from Pemex since it began in the 30s.
Yeah, and this is not really the left. That would be incorrect to call these sort of corrupt old guard pre-unions as being part of the left. To the contrary, these are unions which have been very much co-opted by the government for many years, and there are sort of democratic currents within those and other unions, but which have not been able to actually take control of them. And so that's the problem, sort of this corporatist top-down control of the unions by the government, which the PAN has just continued on. Yes, the PRI is very much alive today, both as a party, it's still very powerful in Congress and in state and local governments, and also sort of has revived itself within the new PAN government. The PAN is the sort of the center-right Christian democratic party, which actually even before the democratic transition was very much allied to the PRI. They were always sort of a comfortable opposition, and now that they've come into power, the PRI has become the comfortable opposition. They've been working together. And there hasn't been this before and after in terms of the way in which power and authority is distributed and exercised in Mexico. And that's definitely the heart of the problem. And again, corruption is at the center there. And there's, if you look, for instance, at the last 8 years of the PAN government, you look at who has been appointed. There's a cabinet position which is in charge of combating corruption, right? So the last 8 years, the PAN has basically had political operatives in that position of combating corruption. An ex-governor, the person who is now the president of the PAN was previously the head of the anti-corruption institution in the federal government. So they haven't really taken seriously this task as a technical, serious effort to get to the bottom of this issue. And if things continue on this line, next year, 2009, there are midterm elections. The PRI will probably increase its votes and take even more control over Congress. And it's possible that in 2012, the PRI might come right back to the federal government. So this is a serious problem. This would be, of course, a pre-rethought and with a different modern image, but basically not radically different from what it was in the past. And so there is definitely something to be concerned about here in Mexico.
Well, I you know, without being too dramatic, I mean, it seems to me you're talking about the mafia. I mean, how do you get rid of this kind of political mafia that have sort of bled this country? And they may put on a new face, but the extent to which they've already corrupted the attempts to reform them, or at least co-opted attempts to reform them, is alarming. And I imagine in the case of Pemex, they're using, as they always did, nationalism to to distract people from wholesale theft.
Exactly. I think you're correct. I think mafia is perhaps in a different context, but it does apply in terms of the fact that it is a relatively small group of powerful politicians who have been in power for the last 20, 30 years and continue to be so. One of the major problems here is the issue of impunity, right? That people violate the law and are not actually punished for it. Now, this happens both at the high levels and at low levels. So, for instance, one of the sources of this public security issue is that recent statistics show that only about 2% of all accused criminals are actually brought before a judge. Now, of course, lots of accusations are false accusations, but it's hard to believe that only 2% of those accusations are actually grounded in reality. So this actually, and this is just for everything from common crimes up to more important crimes, this is just the general lack of effectiveness of the Attorney General's office. And at the higher level, we have governors, like the governor of Puebla or the governor of Oaxaca, who are both from the PRI, who have pretty much been clearly demonstrated they are criminals. The governor of Puebla has been implicated in a child prostitution ring and directly threatened and put into jail journalists who tried to expose him on trumped-up charges, of course. The governor of Oaxaca has committed all sorts of violations of human rights and the teachers' movement, for instance, from a couple of years ago. And both of them are sitting there happily in their posts when you can think of the case of New York, for instance, where the governor had to step down because of some personal scandal involving lack of ethics on his part. Here we have serious violations of the law and criminals who are still exercising power as governors of important states. And so this is what is happening. We really need to have a real cleanup of this mafia who's in charge, and also a general transformation of the way in which justice is thought of and the law is applied in Mexico.
I believe that one of the things that's kept the PRI powerful has been their relationship with organized crime, and most of which is derived from the drug trade as a conduit for both cocaine from Colombia and homegrown heroin, methamphetamine, and marijuana.
Now, there have not been clear, I couldn't just sort of say that myself, that there aren't obvious legal cases in which political leaders have been thrown into jail based on receiving or helping drug cartels, but that perhaps is the issue, that there is definitely an infiltration of the narco into politics. That's definitely the case. I don't think it's just the PRI. I think the PAN, the new governing party, has also participated in this. This is a very delicate issue, and it's something that definitely needs to be researched. The fact that we don't actually have any clear information on it, that no one's actually been thrown into jail on these charges, does not mean that the problem doesn't exist. Yeah.
Well, I believe yesterday in Tijuana, a couple of criminals belonging to the Arellano Felix cartel, AFO as they're called, were chased by some anti-narco police, apparently the ones that hadn't been infiltrated and corrupted, and they chased them into Carlos Hank Rohn's casino where they were seeking refuge. Yeah. Carlos Hank Rohn, of course, is the son of Carlos Hank Gonzalez, the dinosaur of dinosaurs, former mayor of Tijuana. Himself, a sort of prominent junior dinosaur. It all seems pretty emblematic of what we're saying.
Hank Rohn is a good case of of grounded suspicions that there's some link between politics and
right.
and narco. Yeah, I mean, fortunately, he lost the municipal elections for to be mayor of Tijuana last year,
right.
But he still is a very important political player, and his whole family is very much involved in that.
Right.
Yes, I mean the
and his
not,
fingerprints were. Came up in the assassination of Colosio too, so there's there's a whole, you know, murky subterranean world there. Well, it's sort of depressing conversation we've had, and you know, it's obviously the only people who can fix the country are the Mexican people themselves, and
right.
there was
well,
a lot.
There's some good things going on. There have been some. Important constitutional reforms in the last couple of years. We could talk about it at a different moment. And there's was an important electoral reform last year, for instance, which basically cut out the participation of the private sector in elections. The 2009 elections next year and 2012 for president are going to be based just about entirely, not exclusively, but entirely 80% or so on public monies. That's with the intention of really cutting out the private purchasing of candidates. And so, for instance, television advertisements are now going to be all public time, which is an important change, which is very different from what is in the United States and has been in Mexico. There are important reforms in the area of transparency in government. And there has been an important constitutional reform in the area of public security that's going to have to be implemented over the next 8 years, and we'll see how much of a political will there is actually to change the way in which the justice system works.
I thank you for joining us here in Los Angeles, Dr. John Ackerman.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Dr. John Ackerman, who's a professor at the Institute for Legal Research at the National University of Mexico in Mexico City. I'm now speaking with Aziz Huck, who directs the Liberty and National Security Project at New York University's Brennan Center for Justice. He clerked for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and in 2006 was a recipient of the Carnegie Scholars Fellowship and has published scholarship in the Columbia Law Review, the Yearbook of Islamic and Middle Eastern Law, and the New York New School's Constellations Journal. He's written a number of publications, including the Legal Times and the American Prospect. He's worked on the International Crisis Group in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Nepal on legal and constitutional reform issues, and he's the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced Presidential Power in a Time of Terror, which has just been published in paperback. This the extent to which we know about the Attorney General Michael Mukasey's new push for greater FBI powers to spy on citizens, I guess, comes from a couple of dissident senators, if you will, who've alerted the public and the press that something nasty's in the pipeline. Am I correct?
Somewhat. The new Attorney General's guidelines for FBI investigations were reported by the Associated Press at the beginning of July. And the key details which are which concern what the trigger is for new investigations were actually detailed in those Associated Press articles.
And what's got people so alarmed then?
Well, the reason these guidelines are important is that the FBI does not have a governing statute that sets out and limits its investigative powers. The FBI has developed in what it turns out to be a very haphazard way. It was founded about 100 years ago. Congress has never sat down and said, this is exactly what we want it to do. There was an effort to do that in the late 1970s after the FBI's COINTEL program came to light, but it was stymied by the then Attorney General, Edward Leavy, who issued four sets of guidelines setting forth limits on different FBI powers that had raised concern. So one of those was when you could start an investigation. And in the Leavy guidelines, the rule was that even in domestic security investigations, an agent needed to have an articulable reason, a reasonable basis, in other words, of actual criminal activity before he or she could begin investigating a person or an organization. And this was meant to stop the FBI from intruding on the First Amendment rights of unpopular political groups or minority religious groups. both of which had been targeted over the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And over time, those guidelines have been pushed back by succeeding attorney generals, but they've basically kept some constraint on when and the FBI can begin an investigation. What Attorney General Mukasey is apparently proposing, and we only know from the AP stories and a speech that Mukasey gave last week in Portland. We actually haven't seen the guidelines themselves. What he's proposing is to dial down considerably the hurdle that an FBI agent needs to overcome before beginning an investigation. And specifically, an investigation could begin into a person if, on the basis of two things: A, their religious or ethnic identity, and B, the fact that they have traveled overseas. And this is really crucial, but because particularly for those communities, those ethnic and religious communities who the FBI is known to target post 9/11, we're talking about Muslim, South Asian, and Arab communities, pretty much the entire community is going to have gone overseas at some point. So by saying we can spy on you if you have a particular ethnicity or religion, and if you've traveled overseas, well, that really opens the floodgates with respect to those kinds of communities.
And wouldn't it also apply to the broader community? If you allow, once the door is open, once the barn door is open, the horse can bolt, surely. I mean,
I think that there is something to say for that. We know, for example, that the FBI and local police have, over the last 6 or 7 years, deployed a good deal of surveillance resources against anti-war and peace groups. There was evidence that came out only this year of Maryland State Police doing that. And the new FBI guidelines, I think, would make that easier. One of the things that they say, and this is what's relevant, I think, to dissident groups rather than ethnic minorities, one of the things they say is that, well, now we can begin an investigation based upon an algorithmically developed profile that we apply to a database. So what the FBI is going to do is to sum together different pieces of information from the many databases that they have access to, and to identify targets of suspicion based upon information in those databases. So, for example, if you have been photographed at a protest, if you have been cited for some reason during a protest, if you if your name appears on, let's say, a petition that the FBI takes us having, or a local police takes us having been suspicious because it's anti-war, you could end up being picked out by the FBI's algorithm, and based on being picked out, you could be spied upon. That would now be allowed under the new rules.
So, in other words, if you're an active citizen, you're subversive. I mean, I'm leaping to a rather blunt conclusion there, but it's an extraordinary un-American notion, isn't it?
Well, we don't know precisely how the FBI is going to use these powers, but the key thing is that in the past, the guidelines provided some constraint against targeting people based upon their religious views, their ethnic identity, or their First Amendment speech, particularly unpopular political speech. And the proposed changes in the guidelines would considerably draw back on constraints against that on that kind of spying, on that kind of reason. And we also know that intelligence agencies at the federal level and increasingly at the local and state level, and that's very important, are perfectly inclined, are indeed have an affirmative proclivity to target people because of ethnic or religious identity or the expression of First Amendment views.
And if this FBI database is at the heart of this new regime, I understand from the tenure of Louis Freeh that he did everything he could to frustrate them entering the electronic age. And there have been a number of reports that their computer system is dysfunctional. There's also the Homeland Security's and the TSA's watch list has had its problems. It's no-fly list. So what kind of reliability do we have in terms of this database?
We just don't know the answer to that question. I mean, certainly under Robert Mueller's tenure at the FBI, Mueller took over from Free about a week before 9/11. There's been aggressive efforts to improve, they say, the database capacity. So, for example, last year, I believe it was Mueller testified in Congress about efforts to build systems for the FBI would build its own system of link analysis, where it would go through large electronic databases and draw links between people who it had suspicions about, and on the basis of those links, identify new suspects. It's a common way of using databases. So we do know that the FBI has been more aggressive in what they're trying to do with databases. The other thing that we know that they are trying to do, and this is actually something, this is yet another rule change that's coming at the end of the Bush administration. It's an effort to kind of entrench Bush-era policies before a new president comes in. One thing that we know that the administration is doing, because they've issued proposed guidelines about this, is to break down the barriers, the privacy rules, and the guards against improper gathering and sharing of information with respect to local and state agencies. So there is a proposed Department of Justice regulation that would make it much easier for local and state police agencies to share information with the FBI and with other U.S. Federal intelligence bodies. And indeed, this proposed regulation would provide a considerable incentive for local and state agencies to shift from their traditional investigative role, the traditional policing role, to becoming proactively intelligence gathering entities. We've already seen some signs of this both in New York and actually in Los Angeles, where the LAPD, your local police force, or one of them, has been very proactive in developing what it calls a set of suspicious activity report indicia. These are 65 things that LAPD officers are told to look out for because they could be signs that somebody's preparing to commit an act of terrorism. And examples of these are showing sympathy for extremist groups, expressing extremist views, where the word extremist is not defined. Things like taking notes, using binoculars. These are extraordinarily broad, extraordinarily diffuse, leave a lot of discretion in individual officers' basis, and create a very real danger that intelligence gathering, even at the local level, is going to trench on First Amendment rights.
Well, wasn't the problem with 9/11, though, that the intelligence was in there, particularly in the FBI, and Louis Free was possibly the most disastrous steward of the FBI, from what I understand, in terms of his methods. He shut down the most effective al-Qaeda hunter in the agency. I mean, it's an appalling record. So, the problem's not gathering tidbits of information from local police. It seems to be more at the top.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And one way of thinking about it is many of the problems that for example, the 9/11 Commission highlighted were not problems about insufficient evidence gathering or insufficient flow of evidence up down to up, but restrictions on information going up to down. For example, because of things like classification rules and interagency jealousy. So one of the most important failures pre-9/11 was the failure of the CIA to give information about two of the hijackers entering the United States, which the CIA knew, to the FBI, which it could follow up. Another important failure was the failure of FBI headquarters to listen to and to license properly the FBI field offices. So the problems that we were seeing before 9/11, and you've referred to several others, and there's really a cluster of managerial and institutional dysfunction, are really all about top-down management incapacities or errors. And what we've seen, and this is not just true in the surveillance area, but it's true in, for example, the CIA's approach to intelligence gathering through capture, detention, and torture of individuals. Rather than trying to fix institutional problems, rather than trying to fix what actually went wrong, the approach in the last 8 years has been, the last 7 years has been to say, 9/11 happened, therefore we need more power and more information. And there's very little evidence that, sufficient time and effort has gone into actually being able to use either power or information wisely. Having more information in particular can be as harmful as it is beneficial, because it can drown you. It's not clear that if you're looking for a needle in a haystack, the best way to do it is to make the haystack bigger. It's not clear that either the FBI or the CIA have developed really tools to refine down and to manage their own operations well enough to use even the data or the powers they had.
And you're not even including the translation assets, which are years behind in terms of translating stuff that's already been gathered by surveillance.
That's right. And that's particularly a problem for the CIA, the CIA has a set of hiring criteria that make it very difficult for people, even who are first-generation immigrants, who have, you know, whose families came from, say, the Middle East or South Asia, to get hired into the agency, with the result that the people you get hired in are people who certainly don't have cultural experience. They may have some language experience, but you know, it's going to be derivative and secondhand. And this is compounded, at least in the military, I'm not sure about in the CIA, by the don't ask, don't tell policy, where you've had a series of Arabic-speaking military officers, including military intelligence officers, being fired because they're gay, which makes no sense at all in a world in which we're literally U.S. troops are dying because you're not able to process intelligence in Iraq.
I thank you so much for joining us, Aziz Hook. And I guess the point here is that, I mean, what strikes me is that an enduring irony is that our president has said many times that the terrorists who attacked us on 9/11 hate us for our freedoms. And in response to what they did to us, we seem to be attacking our own freedoms. And it seems deep to me, at least, deeply dysfunctional.
Well, it's more politically popular rather than setting your own house in order.
I thank you for joining us, Aziz Hook.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was just speaking then with Aziz Hook, who directs the Liberty and National Security Project at New York University's Brennan Center. He's the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the associate producer, Elliot Fong, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.